commodity lies hidden in the value relation of two commodities, we must, in the first place, consider the latter entirely apart from its quantitative aspect. The usual mode of procedure is generally the reverse, and in the value relation nothing is seen but the proportion between definite quantities of two different sorts of commodities that are considered equal to each other. It is apt to be forgotten that the magnitudes of different things can be compared quantitatively only when those magnitudes are expressed in terms of the same unit. It is only as expressions of such a unit that they are of the same denomination, and therefore commensurable. Footnote. The few economists, amongst whom is S. Bailey, who have occupied themselves with the analysis of the form of value, have been unable to arrive at any result, first because they confuse the form of value with value itself, and second because under the coarse influence of the practical bourgeois, they exclusively give their attention to the quantitative aspect of the question. The command of quantity constitutes value. Money and its vicissitudes. London, 1837, by S. Bailey. End of footnote. Whether 20 yards of linen equals 1 coat, or equals 20 coats, or equals X coats, that is, whether a given quantity of linen is worth few or many coats, every such statement implies that the linen and coats, as magnitudes of value, are expressions of the same unit, things of the same kind. Linen equals coat is the basis of the equation. But the two commodities, whose identity of quality is thus assumed, do not play the same part. It is only the value of the linen that is expressed. And how? By its reference to the coat as its equivalent, as something that can be exchanged for it. In this relation, the coat is the mode of existence of value, is value embodied. For only as such is it the same as the linen. On the other hand, the linen's own value comes to the front, receives independent expression, for it is only as being value that it is comparable with the coat as a thing of equal value, or exchangeable with the coat. To borrow an illustration from chemistry, butyric acid is a different substance from propyl formate, yet both are made up of the same chemical substances, carbon C, hydrogen H, and oxygen O, and that too in like proportions, namely C4H8O2. If now we equate butyric acid to propyl formate, then, in the first place, propyl formate would be, in this relation, merely a form of existence of C4H8O2. And in the second place, we should be stating that butyric acid also consists of C4H8O2. Therefore, by thus equating the two substances, expression would be given to their chemical composition, while their different physical forms would be neglected. If we say that, as values, commodities are mere congelations of human labour, we reduce them by our analysis, it is true, to the abstraction value. But we ascribe to this value no form apart from their bodily form. It is otherwise in the value relation of one commodity to another. Here, the one stands forth in its character of value by reason of its relation to the other. By making the coat the equivalent of the linen, we equate the labour embodied in the former to that in the latter. Now, it is true that the tailoring, which makes the coat, is concrete labour of a different sort from the weaving which makes the linen. But the act of equating it to the weaving reduces the tailoring to that which is really equal in the two kinds of labour, to their common character of human labour. In this roundabout way, then, the fact is expressed that weaving also, in so far as it weaves value, has nothing to distinguish it from tailoring, and consequently is abstract human labour. It is the expression of equivalence between different sorts of commodities that alone brings into relief the specific character of value-creating labour, and this it does by actually reducing the different varieties of labour embodied in the different kinds of commodities to their common quality of human labour in the abstract. Footnote. The celebrated Franklin, one of the first economists, after William Petty, who saw through the nature of value, says, "Trade in general being nothing else but the exchange of labour for labour, the value of all things is, most justly, measured by labour." The works of B. Franklin, etc., edited by Sparks, Boston, 1836. Franklin is unconscious that by estimating the value of everything in labour, he makes abstraction from any difference in the sorts of labour exchanged, and thus reduces them all to equal human labour. But although ignorant of this, yet he says it. He speaks first of the one labour, then of the other labour, and finally of labour, without further qualification, as the substance of the value of everything. End of footnote. There is, however, something else required beyond the expression of the specific character of the labour of which the value of the linen consists. Human labour power in motion, or human labour, creates value, but is not itself value. It becomes value only in its congealed state, when embodied in the form of some object. In order to express the value of the linen as a congelation of human labour, that value must be expressed as having objective existence, as being a something materially different from the linen itself, and yet a something common to the linen and all other commodities. The problem is already solved. When occupying the position of equivalent in the equation of value, the coat ranks qualitatively as the equal of the linen, as something of the same kind, because it is value. In this position, it is a thing in which we see nothing but value, or whose palpable bodily form represents value. Yet the coat itself, the body of the commodity coat, is a mere use value. A coat, as such, no more tells us it is value than does the first piece of linen we take hold of. This shows that when placed in value relation to the linen, the coat signifies more than when out of that relation, just as many a man strutting about in a gorgeous uniform counts for more than when in mufti. In the production of the coat, human labour power in the shape of tailoring must have been actually expended. Human labour is therefore accumulated in it. In this aspect, the coat is a depository of value, but though worn to a thread, it does not let this fact show through. And as equivalent of the linen in the value equation, it exists under this aspect alone, counts therefore as embodied value, as a body that is value. A, for instance, cannot be Your Majesty to be, unless at the same time Majesty in B's eyes assumes the bodily form of A. And, what is more, with every new father of the people, changes its features, hair, and many other things besides. Hence, in the value equation, in which the coat is the equivalent of the linen, the coat officiates as the form of value. The value of the commodity linen is expressed by the bodily form of the commodity coat, the value of one by the use value of the other. As a use value, the linen is something palpably different from the coat. As value, it is the same as the coat, and now has the appearance of a coat. Thus the linen acquires a value form different from its physical form. The fact that it is value is made manifest by its equality with the coat, just as the sheep's nature of a Christian is shown in his resemblance to the Lamb of God. We see, then, all that our analysis of the value of commodities has already told us, is told us by the linen itself, so soon as it comes into communication with another commodity, the coat. Only it betrays its thoughts in that language with which it alone is familiar, the language of commodities. In order to tell us that its own value is created by labour in its abstract character of human labour, it says that the coat, in so far as it is worth as much as the linen, and therefore is value, consists of the same labour as the linen. In order to inform us that its sublime reality as value is not the same as its Bakram body, it says that value has the appearance of a coat, and consequently that so far as the linen is value, it and the coat are as like as two peas. We may here remark that the language of commodities has, besides Hebrew, many other more or less correct dialects. The German Wertsein, to be worth, for instance, expresses in a less striking manner than the Romance verbs valere, vale, valoir, that the equating of commodity B to commodity A is commodity A's own mode of expressing its value. Paris vaut bien une messe. Paris is certainly worth a mass. By means, therefore, of the value relation expressed in our equation, the bodily form of commodity B becomes the value form of commodity A, or the body of commodity B acts as a mirror to the value of commodity A. Footnote. In a sort of way, it is with man as with commodities. Since he comes into the world neither with a looking-glass in his hand, nor as a Fichtean philosopher to whom I am I is sufficient, man first sees and recognizes himself in other men. Peter only establishes his own identity as a man by first comparing himself with Paul as being of like kind. And thereby Paul, just as he stands in his Pauline personality, becomes to Peter the type of the genus Homo. End of footnote. By putting itself in relation with commodity B, as value in propria persona, as the matter of which human labour is made up, the commodity A converts the value in use B into the substance in which to express its, A's, own value. The value of A, thus expressed in the use value of B, has taken the form of relative value. B. Quantitative determination of relative value. Every commodity, whose value it is intended to express, is a useful object of given quantity, as 15 bushels of corn, or 100 pounds of coffee. And a given quantity of any commodity contains a definite quantity of human labour. The value form must therefore not only express value generally, but also value in definite quantity. Therefore, in the value relation of commodity A to commodity B, of the linen to the coat, not only is the latter as value in general made the equal in quality of the linen, but a definite quantity of coat, one coat, is made the equivalent of a definite quantity, 20 yards, of linen. The equation 20 yards of linen equals one coat, or 20 yards of linen are worth one coat, implies that the same quantity of value substance, congealed labour, is embodied in both, that the two commodities have each cost the same amount of labour of the same quantity of labour time. But the labour time necessary for the production of 20 yards of linen, or one coat, varies with every change in the productiveness of weaving or tailoring. We have now to consider the influence of such changes on the quantitative aspect of the relative expression of value. 1. Let the value of the linen vary, that of the coat remain constant. Footnote. Value is here, as occasionally in the preceding pages, used in sense of value determined as to quantity or of magnitude of value. End of footnote. If, say, in consequence of the exhaustion of flax-growing soil, the labour time necessary for the production of the linen be doubled, the value of the linen will also be doubled. Instead of the equation 20 yards of linen equals one coat, we should have 20 yards of linen equals two coats, since one coat would now contain only half the labour time, embodied in 20 yards of linen. If, on the other hand, in consequence, say, of improved looms, this labour time be reduced by one-half, the value of the linen would fall by one-half. Consequently, we should have 20 yards of linen equals half a coat. The relative value of commodity A, that is, its value expressed in commodity B, rises and falls directly as the value of A, the value of B being supposed constant. 2. Let the value of the linen remain constant, while the value of the coat varies. If, under these circumstances, in consequence, for instance, of a poor crop of wool, the labour time necessary for the production of a coat becomes doubled, we have instead of 20 yards of linen equals one coat, 20 yards of linen equals half a coat. If, on the other hand, the value of the coat sinks by one-half, then 20 yards of linen equals two coats. Hence, if the value of commodity A remain constant, its relative value expressed in commodity B rises and falls inversely as the value of B. If we compare the different cases in 1 and 2, we see that the same change of magnitude in relative value may arise from totally opposite causes. Thus, the equation 20 yards of linen equals one coat becomes 20 yards of linen equals two coats, either because the value of the linen has doubled or because the value of the coat has fallen by one-half, and it becomes 20 yards of linen equals half a coat, either because the value of the linen has fallen by one-half or because the value of the coat has doubled. 3. Let the quantities of labour time respectively necessary for the production of the linen and the coat vary simultaneously in the same direction and in the same proportion. In this case, 20 yards of linen continue equal to one coat, however much their values may have altered. Their change of value is seen as soon as they are compared with a third commodity, whose value has remained constant. If the values of all commodities rose or fell simultaneously and in the same proportion, their relative values would remain unaltered. Their real change of value would appear from the diminished or increased quantity of commodities produced in a given time. 4. The labour time respectively necessary for the production of the linen and the coat, and therefore the value of these commodities, may simultaneously vary in the same direction, but at unequal rates, or in opposite directions, or in other ways. The effect of all these possible different variations on the relative value of a commodity may be deduced from the results of 1, 2, and 3. Thus, real changes in the magnitude of value are neither unequivocally nor exhaustively reflected in their relative expression, that is, in the equation expressing the magnitude of relative value. The relative value of a commodity may vary, although its value remains constant. Its relative value may remain constant, although its value varies. And finally, simultaneous variations in the magnitude of value and in that of its relative expression by no means necessarily correspond in amount. Footnote. This incongruity between the magnitude of value and its relative expression has, with customary ingenuity, been exploited by vulgar economists. For example, once admit that A falls because B, with which it is exchanged, rises, while no less labour is bestowed in the meantime on A, and your general principle of value falls to the ground. If he, Ricardo, allowed that when A rises in value relatively to B, B falls in value relatively to A, he cut away the ground on which he rested his grand proposition that the value of a commodity is ever determined by the labour embodied in it. For if a change in the cost of A alters not only its own value in relation to B, for which it is exchanged, but also the value of B relatively to that of A, though no change has taken place in the quantity of labour to produce B, then not only the doctrine falls to the ground which asserts that the quantity of labour bestowed on an article regulates its value, but also that which affirms the cost of an article to regulate its value. J. Broadhurst, Political Economy, London, 1842. Mr. Broadhurst might just as well say, consider the fractions 10 over 20, 10 over 50, 10 over 100, etc. The number 10 remains unchanged, and yet its proportional magnitude, its magnitude relatively to the numbers 20, 50, 100, etc., continually diminishes. Therefore, the great principle that the magnitude of a whole number, such as 10, is regulated by the number of times unity is contained in it, falls to the ground. The author explains in section 4 of this chapter what he understands by vulgar economy. Engels. End of footnote. 3. The equivalent form of value. We have seen that the commodity A, the linen, by expressing its value in the use value of a commodity differing in kind, the coat, at the same time impresses upon the latter a specific form of value, namely that of the equivalent. The commodity linen manifests its quality of having a value by the fact that the coat, without having assumed a value form different from its bodily form, is equated to the linen. The fact that the latter, therefore, has a value is expressed by saying that the coat is directly exchangeable with it. Therefore, when we say that a commodity is in the equivalent form, we express the fact that it is directly exchangeable with other commodities. When one commodity, such as a coat, serves as the equivalent of another, such as linen, and coats consequently acquire the characteristic property of being directly exchangeable with linen, we are far from knowing in what proportion the two are exchangeable. The value of the linen being given in magnitude, that proportion depends on the value of the coat. Whether the coat serves as the equivalent and the linen as relative value, or the linen as the equivalent and the coat as relative value, the magnitude of the coat's value is determined, independently of its value form, by the labour time necessary for its production. But whenever the coat assumes in the equation of value the position of equivalent, its value acquires no quantitative expression. On the contrary, the commodity coat now figures only as a definite quantity of some article. For instance, 40 yards of linen are worth, what? 2 coats. Because the commodity coat here plays the part of equivalent, because the use-value coat, as opposed to the linen, figures as an embodiment of value. Therefore, a definite number of coats suffices to express the definite quantity of value in the linen. 2 coats may therefore express the quantity of value of 40 yards of linen, but they can never express the quantity of their own value. A superficial observation of this fact, namely that in the equation of value, the equivalent figures exclusively as a simple quantity of some article, of some use value, has misled Bailey, as also many others, both before and after him, into seeing in the expression of value merely a quantitative relation. The truth being that when a commodity acts as equivalent, no quantitative determination of its value is expressed. The first peculiarity that strikes us in considering the form of the equivalent is this. Use value becomes the form of manifestation, the phenomenal form of its opposite, value. The bodily form of the commodity becomes its value form. But, mark well, that this quid pro quo exists in the case of any commodity B only when some other commodity A enters into a value relation with it, and then only within the limits of this relation. Since no commodity can stand in the relation of equivalent to itself, and thus turn its own bodily shape into the expression of its own value, every commodity is compelled to choose some other commodity for its equivalent, and to accept the use value, that is to say, the bodily shape of that other commodity as the form of its own value. One of the measures that we apply to commodities as material substances, as use values, will serve to illustrate this point. A sugar loaf, being a body, is heavy, and therefore has weight. But we can neither see nor touch this weight. We then take various pieces of iron whose weight has been determined beforehand. The iron, as iron, is no more the form of manifestation of weight than is the sugar loaf. Nevertheless, in order to express the sugar loaf as so much weight, we put it into a weight relation with the iron. In this relation, the iron officiates as a body representing nothing but weight. A certain quantity of iron therefore serves as the measure of the weight of the sugar, and represents, in relation to the sugar loaf, weight embodied, the form of manifestation of weight. This part is played by the iron only within this relation, into which the sugar or any other body, whose weight has to be determined, enters with the iron. Were they not both heavy, they could not enter into this relation, and the one could therefore not serve as the expression of the weight of the other. When we throw both onto the scales, we see in reality that as weight they are both the same, and that, therefore, when taken in proper proportions, they have the same weight. Just as the substance iron, as a measure of weight, represents in relation to the sugar loaf weight alone, so in our expression of value, the material object, coat, in relation to the linen, represents value alone. Here, however, the analogy ceases. The iron, in the expression of the weight of the sugar loaf, represents a natural property common to both bodies, namely their weight. But the coat, in the expression of value of the linen, represents a non-natural property of both, something purely social, namely their value. Since the relative form of value of a commodity, the linen, for example, expresses the value of that commodity as being something wholly different from its substance and properties, as being, for instance, coat-like, we see that this expression itself indicates that some social relation lies at the bottom of it. With the equivalent form, it is just the contrary. The very essence of this form is that the material commodity itself, the coat, just as it is, expresses value, and is endowed with the form of value by nature itself. Of course, this holds good only so long as the value relation exists, in which the coat stands in the position of equivalent to the linen. Footnote. Such expressions of relations in general, called by Hegel reflex categories, form a very curious class. For instance, one man is king only because other men stand in the relation of subjects to him. They, on the contrary, imagine that they are subjects because he is king. End of footnote. Since, however, the properties of a thing are not the result of its relations to other things, but only manifest themselves in such relations, the coat seems to be endowed with its equivalent form, its property of being directly exchangeable, just as much by nature as it is endowed with the property of being heavy, or the capacity to keep us warm. hence the enigmatical character of the equivalent form which escapes the notice of the bourgeois political economist, until this form, completely developed, confronts him in the shape of money. He then seeks to explain away the mystical character of gold and silver by substituting for them less dazzling commodities, and by reciting, with ever-renewed satisfaction, the catalogue of all possible commodities which at one time or another have played the part of equivalent. He has not the least suspicion that the most simple expression of value, such as 20 yards of linen equals 1 coat, already propounds the riddle of the equivalent form for our solution. The body of the commodity that serves as the equivalent figures as the materialization of human labor in the abstract, and is at the same time the product of some specifically useful concrete labor. This concrete labor becomes, therefore, the medium for expressing abstract human labor. If on the one hand the coat ranks as nothing but the embodiment of abstract human labor, so on the other hand the tailoring which is actually embodied in it counts as nothing but the form under which that abstract labor is realized. In the expression of value of the linen, the utility of the tailoring consists not in making clothes, but in making an object, which we at once recognize to be value, and therefore to be a congelation of labor, but of labor indistinguishable from that realized in the value of the linen. In order to act as such a mirror of value, the labor of tailoring must reflect nothing besides its own abstract quality of being human labor generally. In tailoring, as well as in weaving, human labor power is expended. Both, therefore, possess the general property of being human labor, and may, therefore, in certain cases, such as in the production of value, have to be considered under this aspect alone. There is nothing mysterious in this, but in the expression of value there is a complete turn of the tables. For instance, how is the fact to be expressed that weaving creates the value of the linen not by virtue of being weaving, as such, but by reason of its general property of being human labor? Simply by opposing to weaving that other particular form of concrete labor, in this instance tailoring, which produces the equivalent of the product of weaving. Just as the coat in its bodily form became a direct expression of value, so now does tailoring, a concrete form of labor, appear as the direct and palpable embodiment of human labor generally. Hence, the second peculiarity of the equivalent form is that concrete labor becomes the form under which its opposite, abstract human labor, manifests itself. But because this concrete labor, tailoring in our case, ranks as, and is directly identified with, undifferentiated human labor, it also ranks as identical with any other sort of labor, and therefore with that embodied in the linen. Consequently, although, like all other commodity-producing labor, it is the labor of private individuals, yet, at the same time, it ranks as labor directly social in its character. This is the reason why it results in a product directly exchangeable with other commodities. We have, then, a third peculiarity of the equivalent form, namely, that the labor of private individuals takes the form of its opposite, labor directly social in its form. The two latter peculiarities of the equivalent form will become more intelligible if we go back to the great thinker who was the first to analyze so many forms, whether of thought, society, or nature, and amongst them also the form of value. I mean Aristotle. In the first place, he clearly enunciates that the money form of commodities is only the further development of the simple form of value, that is, of the expression of the value of one commodity in some other commodity taken at random, for he says, five beds equals one house is not to be distinguished from five beds equals so much money. He further sees that the value relation which gives rise to this expression makes it necessary that the house should qualitatively be made equal of the bed, and that without such an equalization, these two clearly different things could not be compared with each other as commensurable quantities. Exchange, he says, cannot take place without equality, and equality not without commensurability. Here, however, he comes to a stop, and gives up the further analysis of the form of value. It is, however, in reality impossible that such unlike things can be commensurable, that is, qualitatively equal. Such an equalization can only be something foreign to their real nature, consequently only a makeshift for practical purposes. Aristotle, therefore, himself tells us what barred the way to his further analysis. It was the absence of any concept of value. What is that equal something, that common substance, which admits of the value of the beds being expressed by a house? Such a thing, in truth, cannot exist, says Aristotle. And why not? Compared with the beds, the house does represent something equal to them, in so far as it represents what is really equal, both in the beds and the house, and that is human labour. There was, however, an important fact which prevented Aristotle from seeing that to attribute value to commodities is merely a mode of expressing all labour as equal human labour, and consequently as labour of equal quality. Greek society was founded upon slavery, and had therefore for its natural basis the inequality of men and of their labour powers. The secret of the expression of value, namely that all kinds of labour are equal and equivalent, cannot be deciphered until the notion of human equality has already acquired the fixity of a popular prejudice. This, however, is possible only in a society in which the great mass of the produce of labour takes the form of commodities, in which, consequently, the dominant relation between man and man is that of owners of commodities. The brilliancy of Aristotle's genius is shown by this alone, that he discovered, in the expression of the value of commodities, a relation of equality. The peculiar conditions of the society in which he lived alone prevented him from discovering what, in truth, was at the bottom of this equality. 4. The elementary form of value considered as a whole. The elementary form of value of a commodity is contained in the equation expressing its value relation to another commodity of a different kind, or in its exchange relation to the same. The value of commodity A is qualitatively expressed by the fact that commodity B is directly exchangeable with it. Its value is quantitatively expressed by the fact that a definite quantity of B is exchangeable with a definite quantity of A. In other words, the value of a commodity obtains independent and definite expression by taking the form of exchange value. When, at the beginning of this chapter, we said, in common parlance, that a commodity is both a use value and an exchange value, we were, accurately speaking, wrong. A commodity is a use value or object of utility and a value. It manifests itself as this twofold thing as soon as its value assumes an independent form, viz., the form of exchange value. It never assumes this form when isolated, but only when placed in a value or exchange relation with another commodity of a different kind. When once we know this, such a mode of expression does no harm. It simply serves as an abbreviation. Our analysis has shown that the form or expression of the value of a commodity originates in the nature of value, and not that value and its magnitude originate in the mode of their expression as exchange value. This, however, is the delusion as well of the mercantilists and their recent revivers, Ferrier, Garnier, and others, as also of their antipodes, the modern bagmen of free trade, such as Bastiat. Footnote. F.L.A. Ferrier, Deputy Inspector of Customs, du gouvernement considéré dans ses rapports avec le commerce. Paris, 1805. And Charles Garnier, Des systèmes d'économie politique. Paris, 1821. End of footnote. The mercantilists lay special stress on the qualitative aspect of the expression of value, and consequently on the equivalent form of commodities which attains its full perfection in money. The modern hawkers of free trade, who must get rid of their article at any price, on the other hand lay most stress on the quantitative aspect of the relative form of value. For them, there consequently exists neither value nor magnitude of value anywhere except in its expression by means of the exchange relation of commodities, that is, in the daily list of prices current. MacLeod, who has taken upon himself to dress up the confused ideas of Lombard Street in the most learned finery, is a successful cross between the superstitious mercantilists and the enlightened free trade bagmen. A close scrutiny of the expression of the value of A in terms of B, contained in the equation expressing the value relation of A to B, has shown us that within that relation, the bodily form of A figures only as a use value, the bodily form of B only as the form or aspect of value. The opposition or contrast existing internally in each commodity between use value and value is therefore made evident externally by two commodities being placed in such relation to each other that the commodity whose value it is sought to express figures directly as a mere use value, while the commodity in which that value is to be expressed figures directly as mere exchange value. Hence the elementary form or value of a commodity is the elementary form in which the contrast contained in that commodity, between use value and value, becomes apparent. Every product of labour is, in all states of society, a use value. But it is only at a definite historical epoch in a society's development that such a product becomes a commodity, viz., at the epoch when the labour spent on the production of a useful article becomes expressed as one of the objective qualities of that article, that is, as its value. It therefore follows that the elementary value form is also the primitive form under which a product of labour appears historically as a commodity, and that the gradual transformation of such products into commodities proceeds pari passu with the development of the value form. We perceive, at first sight, the deficiencies of the elementary form of value. It is a mere germ, which must undergo a series of metamorphoses before it can ripen into the price form. The expression of the value of commodity A in terms of any other commodity B merely distinguishes the value from the use value of A, and therefore places A merely in a relation of exchange with a single different commodity B. But it is still far from expressing A's qualitative equality and quantitative proportionality to all commodities. To the elementary relative value form of a commodity, there corresponds the single equivalent form of one other commodity. Thus, in the relative expression of value of the linen, the coat assumes the form of equivalent, or of being directly exchangeable, only in relation to a single commodity, the linen. Nevertheless, the elementary form of value passes by an easy transition into a more complete form. It is true that by means of the elementary form, the value of a commodity A becomes expressed in terms of one and only one other commodity, but that one may be a commodity of any kind, coat, iron, corn, or anything else. Therefore, according as A is placed in relation with one or the other, we get for one and the same commodity different elementary expressions of value. Footnote. In Homer, for instance, the value of an article is expressed in a series of different things. End of footnote. The number of such possible expressions is limited only by the number of the different kinds of commodities distinct from it. The isolated expression of A's value is therefore convertible into a series, prolonged to any length, of the different elementary expressions of that value. 20 yards of linen equals one coat, or equals 10 pounds of tea, or equals 40 pounds of coffee, or equals one quarter of corn, or equals 2 ounces of gold, or half a ton of iron, or equals etc. B. Total or expanded form of value. 1. The expanded relative form of value. The value of a single commodity, the linen, for example, is now expressed in terms of numberless other elements of the world of commodities. Every other commodity now becomes a mirror of the linen's value. Footnote. For this reason, we can speak of the coat value of the linen when its value is expressed in coats, or of its corn value when expressed in corn, and so on. Every such expression tells us that what appears in the use values, coat, corn, etc., is the value of the linen. The value of any commodity denoting its relation in exchange, we may speak of it as corn value, cloth value, according to the commodity with which it is compared, and hence there are 1,000 different kinds of value, as many kinds of value as there are commodities in existence, and all are equally real and equally nominal. A critical dissertation on the nature, measures, and causes of value, chiefly in reference to the writings of Mr. Ricardo and his followers. By the author of Essays on the Formation, etc. of Opinions, London, 1825. S. Bailey, the author of this anonymous work, a work which in its day created much stir in England, fancied that, by thus pointing out the various relative expressions of one and the same value, he had proved the impossibility of any determination of the concept of value. However narrow his own views may have been, yet that he laid his finger on some serious defects in the Ricardian theory is proved by the animosity with which he was attacked by Ricardo's followers. See the Westminster Review, for example. End of footnote. It is thus that for the first time this value shows itself in its true light as a congelation of undifferentiated human labour. For the labour that creates it now stands expressly revealed as labour that ranks equally with every other sort of human labour, no matter what its form, whether tailoring, ploughing, mining, etc., and no matter, therefore, whether it is realised in coats, corn, iron, or gold. The linen, by virtue of the form of its value, now stands in a social relation, no longer with only one other kind of commodity, but with the whole world of commodities. As a commodity, it is a citizen of that world. At the same time, the interminable series of value equations implies that as regards the value of a commodity, It is a matter of indifference under what particular form or kind of use-value it appears. In the first form, 20 yards of linen equals 1 coat. It might, for aught that otherwise appears, be pure accident that these 2 commodities are exchangeable in definite quantities. In the second form, on the contrary, we perceive at once the background that determines and is essentially different from this accidental appearance. The value of the linen remains unaltered in magnitude, whether expressed in coats, coffee, or iron, or in numberless different commodities, the property of as many different owners. The accidental relation between 2 individual commodity owners disappears. It becomes plain that it is not the exchange of commodities which regulates the magnitude of their value, but on the contrary, that it is the magnitude of their value which controls their exchange proportions. 2. The particular equivalent form. Each commodity, such as coat, tea, corn, iron, etc., figures in the expression of value of the linen as an equivalent, and consequently as a thing that is value. The bodily form of each of these commodities figures now as a particular equivalent form, one out of many. In the same way, the manifold concrete useful kinds of labour, embodied in these different commodities, rank now as so many different forms of the realisation or manifestation of undifferentiated human labour. 3. Defects of the total or expanded form of value. In the first place, the relative expression of value is incomplete because the series representing it is interminable. The chain of which each equation of value is a link is liable at any moment to be lengthened by each new kind of commodity that comes into existence and furnishes the material for a fresh expression of value. In the second place, it is a many-coloured mosaic of disparate and independent expressions of value. And lastly, if, as must be the case, the relative value of each commodity in turn becomes expressed in this expanded form, we get for each of them a relative value form, different in every case, and consisting of an interminable series of expressions of value. The defects of the expanded relative value form are reflected in the corresponding equivalent form. Since the bodily form of each single commodity is one particular equivalent form amongst numberless others, we have, on the whole, nothing but fragmentary equivalent forms, each excluding the others. In the same way also, the special, concrete, useful kind of labour embodied in each particular equivalent is presented only as a particular kind of labour, and therefore not as an exhaustive representative of human labour generally. The latter, indeed, gains adequate manifestation in the totality of its manifold, particular, concrete forms. But in that case, its expression in an infinite series is ever incomplete and deficient in unity. The expanded relative form is, however, nothing but the sum of the elementary relative expressions or equations of the first kind, such as 20 yards of linen equals 1 coat, 20 yards of linen equals 10 pounds of tea, etc. Each of these implies the corresponding inverted equation. 1 coat equals 20 yards of linen, 10 pounds of tea equals 20 yards of linen, etc. In fact, when a person exchanges his linen for many other commodities, and thus expresses its value in a series of other commodities, it necessarily follows that the various owners of the latter exchange them for the linen, and consequently express the value of their various commodities in one and the same third commodity, the linen. If, then, we reverse the series, 20 yards of linen equals 1 coat, or equals 10 pounds of tea, etc., that is to say, if we give expression to the converse relation already implied in the series, we get one coat, or 10 pounds of tea, or 40 pounds of coffee, or 1/4 of corn, or 2 ounces of gold, or 1/2 ton of iron, X of commodity A, etc., equals 20 yards of linen. C. The general form of value. 1. The altered character of the form of value. All commodities now express their value, 1. In an elementary form, because in a single commodity, 2. With unity, because in one and the same commodity. This form of value is elementary, and the same for all, therefore general. The forms A and B were fit only to express the value of a commodity as something distinct from its use value or material form. The first form, A, furnishes such equations as the following. 1 coat equals 20 yards of linen. 10 pounds of tea equals 1/2 ton of iron. The value of the coat is equated to linen, that of the tea to iron. But to be equated to linen and again to iron is to be as different as are linen and iron. This form, it is plain, occurs practically only in the first beginning, when the products of labour are converted into commodities by accidental and occasional exchanges. The second form, B, distinguishes in a more adequate manner than the first the value of a commodity from its use value, for the value of the coat is there placed in contrast under all possible shapes with the bodily form of the coat. It is equated to linen, to iron, to tea, in short, to everything else, only not to itself, the coat. On the other hand, any general expression of value common to all is directly excluded, for in the equation of value of each commodity, all other commodities now appear only under the form of equivalence. The expanded form of value comes into actual existence for the first time so soon as a particular product of labour, such as cattle, is no longer exceptionally but habitually exchanged for various other commodities. The third and lastly developed form expresses the values of the whole world of commodities in terms of a single commodity set apart for the purpose, namely, the linen, and thus represents to us their values by means of their equality with linen. The value of every commodity is now, by being equated to linen, not only differentiated from its own use value, but from all other use values generally, and is, by that very fact, expressed as that which is common to all commodities. By this form, commodities are, for the first time, effectively brought into relation with one another as values, or made to appear as exchange values. The two earlier forms either express the value of each commodity in terms of a single commodity of a different kind, or in a series of many such commodities. In both cases, it is, so to say, the special business of each single commodity to find an expression for its value, and this it does without the help of the others. These others, with respect to the former, play the passive parts of equivalence. The general form of value, C, results from the joint action of the whole world of commodities, and from that alone. A commodity can acquire a general expression of its value only by all other commodities simultaneously with it, expressing their values in the same equivalent, and every new commodity must follow suit. It thus becomes evident that since the existence of commodities as values is purely social, this social existence can be expressed by the totality of their social relations alone, and consequently that the form of their value must be a socially recognized form. All commodities being equated to linen now appear not only as qualitatively equal as values generally, but also as values whose magnitudes are capable of comparison. By expressing the magnitudes of their values in one and the same material, the linen, those magnitudes are also compared with each other. For instance, 10 pounds of tea equals 20 yards of linen, and 40 pounds of coffee equals 20 yards of linen. Therefore, 10 pounds of tea equals 40 pounds of coffee. In other words, there is contained in 1 pound of coffee only 1/4 as much substance of value, labour, as is contained in 1 pound of tea. The general form of relative value, embracing the whole world of commodities, converts the single commodity that is excluded from the rest and made to play the part of equivalent, here the linen, into the universal equivalent. The bodily form of the linen is now the form assumed in common by the values of all commodities. It therefore becomes directly exchangeable with all and every of them. The substance linen becomes the visible incarnation, the social chrysalis state of every kind of human labour. Weaving, which is the labour of certain private individuals producing a particular article, linen, acquires in consequence a social character, the character of equality with all other kinds of labour. The innumerable equations of which the general form of value is composed equate in turn the labour embodied in the linen to that embodied in every other commodity, and they thus convert weaving into the general form of manifestation of undifferentiated human labour. In this manner, the labour realised in the values of commodities is presented not only under its negative aspect, under which abstraction is made from every concrete form and useful property of actual work, but its own positive nature is made to reveal itself expressly. The general value form is the reduction of all kinds of actual labour to their common character of being human labour generally, of being the expenditure of human labour power. The general value form, which represents all products of labour as mere congelations of undifferentiated human labour, shows by its very structure that it is the social resume of the world of commodities. That form, consequently, makes it indisputably evident that in the world of commodities the character possessed by all labour of being human labour constitutes its specific social character. 2. The interdependent development of the relative form of value and of the equivalent form. The degree of development of the relative form of value corresponds to that of the equivalent form. But we must bear in mind that the development of the latter is only the expression and result of the development of the former. The primary or isolated relative form of value of one commodity converts some other commodity into an isolated equivalent. The expanded form of relative value, which is the expression of the value of one commodity in terms of all other commodities, endows those other commodities with the character of particular equivalents differing in kind. And lastly, a particular kind of commodity acquires the character of universal equivalent because all other commodities make it the material in which they uniformly express their value. The antagonism between the relative form of value and the equivalent form, the two poles of the value form, is developed concurrently with that form itself. The first form, 20 yards of linen equals one coat, already contains this antagonism, without as yet fixing it. According as we read this equation forwards or backwards, the parts played by the linen and the coat are different. In the one case, the relative value of the linen is expressed in the coat. In the other case, the relative value of the coat is expressed in the linen. In this first form of value, therefore, it is difficult to grasp the polar contrast. Form B shows that only one single commodity at a time can completely expand its relative value, and that it acquires this expanded form only because, and insofar as, all other commodities are, with respect to it, equivalents. Here we cannot reverse the equation, as we can the equation 20 yards of linen equals one coat, without altering its general character and converting it from the expanded form of value into the general form of value. Finally, the form C gives to the world of commodities a general social relative form of value, because, and insofar as, thereby all commodities, with the exception of one, are excluded from the equivalent form. A single commodity, the linen, appears therefore to have acquired the character of direct exchangeability with every other commodity because, and insofar as, this character is denied to every other commodity. Footnote. It is by no means self-evident that this character of direct and universal exchangeability is, so to speak, a polar one, and as intimately connected with its opposite pole, the absence of direct exchangeability, as the positive pole of the magnet is with a negative counterpart. It may therefore be imagined that all commodities can simultaneously have this character impressed upon them, just as it can be imagined that all Catholics can be popes together. It is, of course, highly desirable in the eyes of the petit bourgeois, for whom the production of commodities is the nec plus ultra of human freedom and individual independence, that the inconveniences resulting from this character of commodities not being directly exchangeable should be removed. Proudhon's socialism is a working out of this Philistine utopia, a form of socialism which, as I have elsewhere shown, does not possess even the merit of originality. Long before his time, the task was attempted with much better success by Gray, Bray, and others. But for all that, wisdom of this kind flourishes even now in certain circles under the name of science. Never has any school played more tricks with the word science than that of Proudhon, for where thoughts are absent, words are brought in as convenient replacements. Goethe's Faust. See Proudhon's Philosophy of Poverty. End of footnote. The commodity that figures as universal equivalent is, on the other hand, excluded from the relative value form. If the linen, or any other commodity serving as universal equivalent, were at the same time to share in the relative form of value, it would have to serve as its own equivalent. We should then have 20 yards of linen equals 20 yards of linen. This tautology expresses neither value nor magnitude of value. In order to express the relative value of the universal equivalent, we must rather reverse the form C. This equivalent has no relative form of value in common with other commodities, but its value is relatively expressed by a never-ending series of other commodities. Thus, the expanded form of relative value, or form B, now shows itself as the specific form of relative value for the equivalent commodity. 3. Transition from the general form of value to the money form. The universal equivalent form is a form of value in general. It can therefore be assumed by any commodity. On the other hand, if a commodity be found to have assumed the universal equivalent form, form C, this is only because and insofar as it has been excluded from the rest of all other commodities as their equivalent, and that by their own act. And from the moment that this exclusion becomes finally restricted to one particular commodity, from that moment only the general form of relative value of the world of commodities obtains real consistence and general social validity. the particular commodity with whose bodily form the equivalent form is thus socially identified, now becomes the money commodity, or serves as money. It becomes the special social function of that commodity, and consequently its social monopoly, to play within the world of commodities the part of the universal equivalent. Amongst the commodities which, in form B, figure as particular equivalents of the linen, and in form C express in common their relative values in linen, this foremost place has been attained by one in particular, namely, gold. If, then, in form C we replace the linen by gold, we get 20 yards of linen equals 1 coat equals 10 pounds of tea equals 40 pounds of coffee equals 1/4 of corn equals 1/2 ton of iron equals X commodity A equals 2 ounces of gold. D. The money form. In passing from form A to form B, and from the latter to form C, the changes are fundamental. On the other hand, there is no difference between forms C and D, except that in the latter, gold has assumed the equivalent form in the place of linen. Gold is in form D what linen was in form C, the universal equivalent. The progress consists in this alone, that the character of direct and universal exchangeability, in other words, that the universal equivalent form, has now, by social custom, become finally identified with the substance gold. Gold is now money with reference to all other commodities only because it was previously, with reference to them, a simple commodity. Like all other commodities, it was also capable of serving as an equivalent, either as simple equivalent in isolated exchanges, or as particular equivalent by the side of others. Gradually it began to serve, within varying limits, as universal equivalent. So soon as it monopolizes this position in the expression of value for the world of commodities, it becomes the money commodity, and then, and not till then, does form D become distinct from form C, and the general form of value become changed into the money form. The elementary expression of the relative value of a single commodity such as linen, in terms of the commodity such as gold that plays the part of money, is the price form of that commodity. The price form of the linen is, therefore, 20 yards of linen equals 2 ounces of gold, or, if 2 ounces of gold when coined are 2 pounds, 20 yards of linen equals 2 pounds. The difficulty in forming a concept of the money form consists in clearly comprehending the universal equivalent form, and as a necessary corollary, the general form of value, form C. The latter is deducible from form B, the expanded form of value. The essential component element of which we saw is form A, 20 yards of linen equals 1 coat, or X commodity A equals Y commodity B. The simple commodity form is therefore the germ of the money form. Section 4. The Fetishism of Commodities and the Secret Thereof. A commodity appears at first sight a very trivial thing, and easily understood. Its analysis shows that it is in reality a very queer thing, abounding in metaphysical subtleties and theological niceties. So far as it is a value in use, there is nothing mysterious about it, whether we consider it from the point of view that by its properties it is capable of satisfying human wants, or from the point that those properties are the product of human labour. It is as clear as noonday that man, by his industry, changes the forms of the materials furnished by nature in such a way as to make them useful to him. The form of wood, for instance, is altered by making a table out of it. Yet, for all that, the table continues to be that common everyday thing, wood. But so soon as it steps forth as a commodity, it is changed into something transcendent. It not only stands with its feet on the ground, but in relation to all other commodities, it stands on its head and evolves out of its wooden brain grotesque ideas far more wonderful than table-turning ever was. The mystical character of commodities does not originate, therefore, in their use-value. Just as little does it proceed from the nature of the determining factors of value. For in the first place, however varied the useful kinds of labour or productive activities may be, it is a physiological fact that they are functions of the human organism, and that each such function, whatever may be its nature or form, is essentially the expenditure of human brain, nerves, muscles, etc. Secondly, with regard to that which forms the groundwork for the quantitative determination of value, namely the duration of that expenditure or the quantity of labour, it is quite clear that there is a palpable difference between its quantity and quality. In all states of society, the labour time that it costs to produce the means of subsistence must necessarily be an object of interest to mankind, though not of equal interest in different stages of development. And lastly, from the moment that men in any way work for one another, their labour assumes a social form. Whence, then, arises the enigmatical character of the product of labour, so soon as it assumes the form of commodities? Clearly from this form itself. The equality of all sorts of human labour is expressed objectively by their products all being equally values. The measure of the expenditure of labour power by the duration of that expenditure takes the form of the quantity of value of the products of labour, and finally, the mutual relations of the producers, within which the social character of their labour affirms itself, take the form of a social relation between the products. A commodity is therefore a mysterious thing, simply because in it the social character of men's labour appears to them as an objective character stamped upon the product of that labour, because the relation of the producers to the sum total of their own labour is presented to them as a social relation, existing not between themselves, but between the products of their labour. This is the reason why the products of labour become commodities, social things whose qualities are at the same time perceptible and imperceptible by the senses. In the same way, the light from an object is perceived by us not as the subjective excitation of our optic nerve, but as the objective form of something outside the eye itself. But in the act of seeing, there is at all events an actual passage of light from one thing to another, from the external object to the eye. There is a physical relation between physical things. But it is different with commodities. There, the existence of the things qua commodities and the value relation between the products of labour which stamps them as commodities have absolutely no connection with their physical properties and with the material relations arising therefrom. There, it is a definite social relation between men that assumes in their eyes the fantastic form of a relation between things. In order, therefore, to find an analogy, we must have recourse to the mist-enveloped regions of the religious world. In that world, the productions of the human brain appear as independent beings, endowed with life, and entering into relation both with one another and the human race. So it is in the world of commodities with the products of men's hands. This I call the fetishism, which attaches itself to the products of labour, so soon as they are produced as commodities, and which is therefore inseparable from the production of commodities. This fetishism of commodities has its origin, as the foregoing analysis has already shown, in the peculiar social character of the labour that produces them. As a general rule, articles of utility become commodities only because they are products of the labour of private individuals or groups of individuals who carry on their work independently of each other. The sum total of the labour of all these private individuals forms the aggregate labour of society. Since the producers do not come into social contact with each other until they exchange their products, the specific social character of each producer's labour does not show itself except in the act of exchange. In other words, the labour of the individual asserts itself as a part of the labour of society only by means of the relations which the act of exchange establishes directly between the products, and indirectly, through them, between the producers. To the latter, therefore, the relations connecting the labour of one individual with that of the rest appear not as direct social relations between individuals at work, but as what they really are, material relations between persons and social relations between things. It is only by being exchanged that the products of labour acquire, as values, one uniform social status distinct from their varied forms of existence as objects of utility. This division of a product into a useful thing and a value becomes practically important only when exchange has acquired such an extension that useful articles are produced for the purpose of being exchanged, and their character as values has therefore to be taken into account beforehand during production. From this moment, the labour of the individual producer acquires socially a twofold character. On the one hand, it must, as a definite useful kind of labour, satisfy a definite social want, and thus hold its place as part and parcel of the collective labour of all, as a branch of a social division of labour that has sprung up spontaneously. On the other hand, it can satisfy the manifold wants of the individual producer himself, only in so far as the mutual exchangeability of all kinds of useful private labour is an established social fact, and therefore the private useful labour of each producer ranks on an equality with that of all others. The equalization of the most different kinds of labour can be the result only of an abstraction from their inequalities, or of reducing them to their common denominator, viz., expenditure of human labour power, or human labour in the abstract. The twofold social character of the labour of the individual appears to him, when reflected in his brain, only under those forms which are impressed upon that labour in everyday practice by the exchange of products. In this way, the character that his own labour possesses of being socially useful takes the form of the condition that the product must be not only useful, but useful for others, and the social character that his particular labour has of being the equal of all other particular kinds of labour takes the form that all the physically different articles that are the products of labour have one common quality, viz., that of having value. Hence, when we bring the products of our labour into relation with each other as values, it is not because we see in these articles the material receptacles of homogeneous human labour. Quite the contrary. Whenever, by an exchange, we equate as values our different products, by that very act we also equate as human labour the different kinds of labour expended on them. We are not aware of this. Nevertheless, we do it. Footnote. When, therefore, Galliani says, value is a relation between persons, he ought to have added, a relation between persons expressed as a relation between things. End of footnote. Value, therefore, does not stalk about with a label describing what it is. It is value rather, that converts every product into a social hieroglyphic. Later on, we try to decipher the hieroglyphic, to get behind the secret of our own social products. For to stamp an object of utility as a value is just as much a social product as language. The recent scientific discovery that the products of labour, so far as they are values, are but material expressions of the human labour spent in their production, marks, indeed, an epoch in the history of the development of the human race, but by no means dissipates the mist through which the social character of labour appears to us to be an objective character of the products themselves. The fact that in the particular form of production with which we are dealing, viz. The production of commodities, the specific social character of private labour carried on independently consists in the equality of every kind of that labour, by virtue of its being human labour, which character therefore assumes in the product the form of value, this fact appears to the producers, notwithstanding the discovery above referred to be just as real and final as the fact that, after the discovery by science of the component gases of air, the atmosphere itself remained unaltered. What first of all practically concerns producers when they make an exchange is the question how much of some other product they get for their own. In what proportions the products are exchangeable. When these proportions have, by custom, attained a certain stability, they appear to result from the nature of the products, so that, for instance, 1 ton of iron and 2 ounces of gold appear as naturally to be of equal value as 1 pound of gold and 1 pound of iron, in spite of their different physical and chemical qualities, appear to be of equal weight. The character of having value, when once impressed upon products, obtains fixity only by reason of their acting and reacting upon each other as quantities of value. These quantities vary continually, independently of the will, foresight, and action of the producers. To them, their own social action takes the form of the action of objects, which rule the producers instead of being ruled by them. It requires a fully developed production of commodities before, from accumulated experience alone, the scientific conviction springs up that all the different kinds of private labour which are carried on independently of each other, and yet as spontaneously developed branches of the social division of labour, are continually being reduced to the quantitative proportions in which society requires them. And why? Because, in the midst of all the accidental and ever-fluctuating exchange relations between the products, the labour time socially necessary for their production forcibly asserts itself like an overriding law of nature. The law of gravity thus asserts itself when a house falls about our ears. Footnote. What are we to think of a law that asserts itself only by periodical revolutions? It is just nothing but a law of nature, founded on the want of knowledge of those whose action is the subject of it. Friedrich Engels. Umrisse zu einer Kritik der Nationalökonomie. In the Deutsch-Französische Jahrbuche. Edited by Arnold Rüger and Karl Marx, Paris, 1844. End of footnote. The determination of the magnitude of value by labour time is therefore a secret, hidden under the apparent fluctuations in the relative values of commodities. Its discovery, while removing all appearance of mere accidentality from the determination of the magnitude of the values of products, yet in no way alters the mode in which that determination takes place. Man's reflections on the forms of social life, and consequently also his scientific analysis of those forms, takes a course directly opposite to that of their actual historical development. He begins, post festum, with the results of the process of development ready to hand before him. the characters that stamp products as commodities and whose establishment is a necessary preliminary to the circulation of commodities, have already acquired the stability of natural, self-understood forms of social life before man seeks to decipher not their historical character, for in his eyes they are immutable, but their meaning. Consequently, it was the analysis of the prices of commodities that alone led to the determination of the magnitude of value, and it was the common expression of all commodities in money that alone led to the establishment of their characters as values. It is, however, just this ultimate money form of the world of commodities that actually conceals, instead of disclosing, the social character of private labour and the social relations between the individual producers. When I state that coats or boots stand in a relation to linen, because it is the universal incarnation of abstract human labour, the absurdity of the statement is self-evident. Nevertheless, when the producers of coats and boots compare those articles with linen, or what is the same thing, with gold or silver, as the universal equivalent, they express the relation between their own private labour and the collective labour of society in the same absurd form. The categories of bourgeois economy consist of such like forms. They are forms of thought expressing with social validity the conditions and relations of a definite, historically determined mode of production, viz. The production of commodities. The whole mystery of commodities, all the magic and necromancy that surrounds the products of labour as long as they take the form of commodities, vanishes, therefore, so soon as we come to other forms of production. Since Robinson Crusoe's experiences are a favourite theme with political economists, let us take a look at him on his island. Footnote. Even Ricardo has his stories, a la Robinson. He makes the primitive hunter and the primitive fisher straightway, as owners of commodities, exchange fish and game in the proportion in which labour time is incorporated in these exchange values. On this occasion, he commits the anachronism of making these men apply to the calculation, so far as their implements have to be taken into account, the annuity tables in current use on the London Exchange in the year 1817. The parallelograms of Mr. Owen appear to be the only form of society, besides the bourgeois form with which he was acquainted. Karl Marx, Zur Kritik, etc. End of footnote. Moderate though he be, yet some few wants he has to satisfy, and must therefore do a little useful work of various sorts, such as making tools and furniture, taming goats, fishing and hunting. Of his prayers and the like we take no account, since they are a source of pleasure to him, and he looks upon them as so much recreation. In spite of the variety of his work, he knows that his labour, whatever its form, is but the activity of one and the same Robinson, and consequently that it consists of nothing but different modes of human labour. Necessity itself compels him to apportion his time accurately between his different kinds of work. Whether one kind occupies a greater space in his general activity than another depends on the difficulties, greater or less as the case may be, to be overcome in attaining the useful effect aimed at. This our friend Robinson soon learns by experience, and having rescued a watch, ledger, and pen and ink from the wreck, commences, like a true-born Briton, to keep a set of books. His stock-book contains a list of the objects of utility that belong to him, of the operations necessary for their production, and lastly, of the labour time that definite quantities of those objects have, on average, cost him. All the relations between Robinson and the objects that form this wealth of his own creation are here so simple and clear as to be intelligible without exertion, even to Mr. Sedley Taylor. And yet those relations contain all that is essential to the determination of value. Let us now transport ourselves from Robinson's Island, bathed in light, to the European Middle Ages, shrouded in darkness. Here, instead of the independent man, we find everyone dependent, serfs and lords, vassals and suzerains, laymen and clergy. Personal dependence here characterizes the social relations of production just as much as it does the other spheres of life organized on the basis of that production. But for the very reason that personal dependence forms the groundwork of society, there is no necessity for labor and its products to assume a fantastic form different from their reality. They take the shape, in the transactions of society, of services in kind and payments